from 90.1 WFYI Public Radio. Welcome to the Art of the Matter, made possible by the ongoing support of listeners like you.
Hello and welcome to The Art of the Matter. I'm Sharon Gamble. The music for today's show is courtesy of the Buselli Wallerab Jazz Orchestra from their Heart and Soul album, available through Owl Studios at owlstudios.com.
And I'm Travis DiNicola. Today I'll get a preview of the Indiana Repertory Theater's new season.
I'll find out about the scary October stories being told by Storytelling Arts.
And I'll chat with Wes von Rutenberg about his grandfather's architectural and design work. Plus, there'll be our arts calendar we call
What'll We do? All that and more right after the latest news from NPR. The Indiana Repertory Theater opened its new season with Arthur Miller's classic, The Crucible. Travis DiNicola sat down with the IRT's artistic director, Janet Allen, to talk about The Crucible, as well as what else they have planned for the new season.
Janet, welcome back to Art of the Matter. Always a pleasure.
Thanks, Travis. I love coming to play with you.
Speaking of plays, so Crucible just opened.
It did.
And boy, is it a powerhouse show to start off the season. Ryan Artsberger gives an amazing performance. This is a really strong show. I mean, it's a classic. I mean, you know, Arthur Miller, this classic American drama. But it has a lot of meaning. Now, it's not just a historical piece.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, indeed. It means way too much still, doesn't it? That's the scary part.
Yeah. Tell me a bit about that.
Yeah. The lens that he had on it, Miller was writing it kind of like Shakespeare would pick a historic moment back in time.
Mm-hmm. To comment on when he was.
Yeah, to comment on his own time. So did Miller. So he was really writing about the McCarthy trials in the 50s and his personal distress about that,
and using the Salem witch hunts to comment on that, and that's really how I've always sort of understood the play is this, you know, as much about what was going on in the 50s as it is about puritanical times.
But as a consequence, it's also about what's going on now. So it also reverberates forward this many years as well. And we were recently saying, what period of American history has this play not resonated in? And the sad news in is all of them. Because we're always subject to fanaticism. We are always subject to vengeance. We are always subject to using religion for false purposes and for personal vendettas. And the play has so much to say to us today, not only about American politics and culture, but about world politics and cultural. One of the things that I find so shocking about it is we forget that at that time, 1692, early settlement, white settlement of the Massachusetts Bay Colony, we lived, our culture was Sharia law.
They didn't call it that, but
they sure didn't call it that, but it's the same thing. The government and religion were the same power. There was no separation of church and state. We forget this. And that is a powerful, powerful statement about where we come from, what those puritanical roots still are in our culture, and how we respond to all this today.
And it is. I mean, so much of it is about power. Who has the power? Yeah. Who has the power to control things? One thing that really stood out for me when I saw the opening of The Crucible was sort of how ironic it is that the culture at the time was so sexist.
Yeah.
And women were treated, I mean, so much as second-class citizens, yet it was truly the women who were driving so much of what was happening underneath that led to what happens in The Crucible.
The women children.
Yes, the women child.
I mean,
it's their way of
Abigail
gaining power.
And Mary. Yeah. These young women, 17, 18-year-old women, are the characters that Miller created. He really conflated these characters out of the historical documents, Travis. The girls that actually kind of created this furor in 1692 were actually considerably younger than these girls. But that wasn't going to make up a great play, and Arthur Miller knew that. So the idea of the sexual politics sort of being an engine and an overlay to this is really what appealed to him. He was a man who struggled with his own faithfulness in marriage. He was married several times. And the piece of it that really
struck him personally,
and that's
an underlying theme throughout all the,
completely, is fidelity in marriage and what is betrayal of marriage? Mm-hmm. And he felt that part very personally. That was the other really personal story of it for him, was that error of judgment that causes John Proctor to fall.
Yeah.
But we can talk about this play as a political, historical, religious document as much as we want, but what it really is, Travis, is a powerhouse for actors.
Yes, it is.
And that's the real money stuff for us. That's when we get to invite actors to just come inhabit that big, big, big
and
stuff.
So and many great actors. Actors who were regulars on the IRT stage, who really got to just, tear up the boards.
Exactly.
And the new actors, too. I mean, I mentioned Ryan Artsberger, Robert Neal, Rob Johansson, Millicent Wright. I'm forgetting a half dozen, it seems, but so many good performances.
Yeah, and also some just great actors from Chicago joining us, some actors from Kansas City joining us. So a whole bunch of other folks coming in. Some of them new, some of them have been here before. Mm-hmm. Steve Pickering, who's playing Danforth, is a leading actor at the Goodman Theater, a company member of that company in Chicago. So it's cool to have something for him to really bite on down here. So we've had a very good time working on it, and we laughed a lot making this thing because you have to.
Mm-hmm.
You have to with that much serious stuff. It is intense.
Now, it is such a huge cast, and I have to say, so a couple weeks ago, the IRT had a really great open house that I was able to attend.
Oh, yay. I'm glad you had fun.
And the one of the most interesting things was being in the costume department, and they were talking about the costuming for The Crucible and how delighted they were that the show afterwards, after doing such a big show like Crucible, that it was a one-man show right afterwards, right?
Now, there's the contrast right there.
Yeah.
I think there's, are there 19 or 20 actors in Crucible? After a while, I just have to stop counting, including a bunch of local girls, we should say. There's some great performances by some high school kids.
Yeah.
Which is a fun piece of it as well. There's actors from 10 to 70 in Crucible.
That's pretty cool.
But the thing that follows is, yes, indeed, a one-man adaptation of The Iliad.
The Iliad.
Doesn't that just make your head spin?
Well, like I said, I know it made your costume department happy.
Yes,
but,
it does indeed. They get a little rest, but then right after that, they work on Christmas Carol, so the rest isn't long. Yeah.
So tell me about this Iliad.
I'd love to.
Yeah.
This is a piece that was really made possible by the fact that there's an amazing, relatively recent translation of Iliad by Robert Fagles, which I'm sure you know about.
Mm-hmm.
The Fagles translation, which is from, I think, the 90s, the late 90s, just breaks open that piece of literature for contemporary reading and for contemporary speaking. And that was really the linchpin for an amazing American director, Lisa Peterson, to gang up with an actor friend, Dennis O'Hare, and create this one-man piece.
Okay.
It's called An Iliad because it's their take on the Iliad. There is a lot of the original document in the piece, but there's also a lot of contemporary references. Essentially, he breaks it down for us so we can understand it in contemporary terms.
So is it Odysseus who is the main actor? No,
he plays Hector, Achilles.
Oh, so all over the place. Okay.
Hecuba, Priam. He's voicing a lot of those characters.
Okay.
Not so much Odysseus, because that's more the Odyssey than
Iliad. Okay.
But the story of the fall of Troy, the story of the years and years of war that the Greeks, the Argives, fought against Troy to return Helen to her family, whether she liked it or not.
Right.
But just that kind of quintessential battle. I read recently
and great love story.
A lot of different love stories. There's love stories between some of the warriors and their wives, and lots of generational love stories as well. There's some very poignant stories about parents and children in it. But the thing that I love, because I love Greek plays and Greek literature, but what we find when we read them now is we just need too many footnotes and we get bored too fast.
Yeah.
This play does all of it. It does all the footnotes within it. It'll say, okay, you don't know who Priam is, but this is who he is. And then he unpacks it.
Huh.
So he, things like in the Iliad, there's this giant list of all of the communities that submitted soldiers.
Mm-hmm.
Well, we don't know the names of those communities anymore, but what he does is he says, well, this would be like there being battle units from Springfield, Illinois, and Kansas City, Missouri, and Chicago, Illinois, and Madison, Wisconsin. And suddenly you get it.
You get
that this is a war like wars we have understood and worried about and worried about financing and hated or whatever we've done or celebrated some of them. So it gets us all the contemporary references that allow us to get in under this story, and it is magnificent. We have Henry Warnitz playing it. Henry played Bottom in our production of Midsummer Night's Dream, a totally opposite kind of character last spring. And Henry's done some other work for us in the past. Henry is a former artistic director of the Oregon Shakespeare Festival, is a nationally known Shakespeare expert actor and director.
Okay.
He did this piece for La Jolla Playhouse in California and Berkeley Rep last year. And when we still weren't able to get the rights to it.
Okay.
We were able to get the rights this year, and Henry agreed to do it here. He lives in Bloomington, Indiana, with his partner, Fontaine Sire, who's directing it. Fontaine is on the theater faculty at IU, so they're working
on it
together, and it goes into rehearsal tomorrow.
Wow, awesome.
Yeah.
Great.
Yeah, I'm really looking forward to it. I've seen...
Oh, I am too now. I mean, and your description really helps me understand it more than what I did before.
It makes your hair stand up. I mean, you it's really to get this great document, which I recently read is considered the foundational document of all of Western literature.
Mm-hmm.
Whoa.
Oh, this will be great.
Yeah.
So when does that open?
Well, you know what? That makes me have to put my glasses on.
Well, sorry about that, Janet.
No, it's all good. It's all good. Its first performance is the 16th of October, Travis, and it opens on the 18th, and it runs through the 16th of November.
Very good.
And one of the beauty parts is we're playing a lot of student matinees of it, which was my secret hope, was that teachers...
Mainly aiming at like high school students?
High school, and some college, but a lot of high school.
Mm-hmm.
We're playing a lot of student matinees of Crucible, but that we expected,
because
that's a piece that's often taught. Iliad's tougher to teach, and we have had a lot of schools stand up and say we want to come. So,
and that's a big part of your audience.
In a year, it's 40%. 40% of our performances and roughly our audience is under 18.
Yeah, that is so cool. But
it's a big
commitment. It's a big part of what you do.
We're passionate about it. Yeah.
Now, of course, Christmas Carol will be.
Always and Forever.
Always and Forever. What an awesome show. Love that production.
Year 19, I think, or 18,
excellent.
You know, one loses count. But, yeah, it gets more magnificent every year. We find all kinds of new things we want to play with every year while maintaining that sort of beautiful snow field and the real immediacy of Dickens' language and some amazing acting.
It's just great theater. What you guys do
is
you know,
it's
what I love about your production of Christmas Carol, and I've said this before, is that it's the type of theater that you can only see on a stage live. You can't recreate that anywhere else the way that you do it. I'm not going to have you go through the whole season, but a couple other things, because we'll have you back on later in the year to catch
That'd
up on
fun.
Stuff. But after Christmas Carol?
Yeah, we're doing two things kind of at once.
Yeah.
One on the upper stage and one on the main stage. We're doing... a new production of James Still, our playwright in residence play. And then They Came for Me, Remembering the World of Anne Frank.
And this is a play you did a couple years back, I remember.
We did it in 2005. Mm-hmm. We did it in 1996. We did the first production of it in 96. And it is a piece based on oral histories that James collected from two of Anne Frank's childhood friends, actual friends. One became Otto Frank's stepdaughter because Otto married Eva Geringer's mother after the war, after his family died in Auschwitz. The other childhood friend is Ed Silverberg, who survived in hiding and was one of Anne Frank's boyfriends in Amsterdam that she writes about in the diary. So these two individuals in their 70s did interviews with James. They're both still alive in their mid-80s. And the play has them in their senior citizen reflecting on their childhood in the play. So it's a multimedia piece. And then it also has actors, youth actors, playing them as young teenagers.
You know, I saw it in 2005, and I remember it was a very sweet love story, in addition to all the historical information.
It's also really powerful because it takes us through Auschwitz and Eva's survival, Eva and her mother's survival, and her learning about the death of Anne. And it's a piece that kind of expands the Anne Frank story
it does.
Say there were so many other kids involved in this, a few of whom survived.
Right.
And so contextualizing that story in a bigger way, I think, is a really great opportunity for kids. And it plays, it will play principally to our youth audience.
Okay.
Then on the main stage at about the same time in late January, February, we are doing a Kurt Vonnegut piece. Which I'm
yeah,
very
tell
excited.
Me about that. We'll wrap up with this one because this is pretty cool. I know you guys are very excited
about
it.
We have been, we're very excited about this. It's called Who Am I This Time and Other Conundrums of Love. And for the Vonnegut aficionados amongst us, Who Am I This Time is the title of a short story that Vonnegut wrote in the 60s that's collected in Welcome to the Monkey House.
Okay.
There are three stories from Monkey House that are adapted by Aaron Posner. Together, and this is only the second production of this. It premiered last year, and we're taking it on for a second time, which Aaron's really excited about because it will move the piece into publication and give it a wider audience in Vonnegut's hometown, which
cool.
we're very, very excited about. So
yeah.
the opportunity to get a Vonnegut conversation rolling off of our stage is
And my
I'm
guess is
about.
You'll maybe be doing something with the Vonnegut Museum.
I think you could be right,
you know?
And with something with Indie Reads
maybe,
and
yep.
something
a great
with
idea.
The public library. So we're talking to all of you guys about how to use your spaces and your wisdoms about Vonnegut to help
awesome.
Us create an event.
That'll
so
be very
thank
cool.
Thank you for that.
Well, great stuff is always going on at the IRT.
Nice.
Janet, a pleasure.
Always,
pleasure to chat
Travis.
With you.
Thanks
so much for coming
to
in today.
Travis DiNicola with the IRT's Artistic Director, Janet Allen. You can get more information about the IRT season at irtlive.com, irtlive.com. You're listening to The Art of the Matter on WFYI 90.1 FM Public Radio.
Everybody knows a scary story or two about a haunted bridge or a headless horseman. Storytelling Arts of Indiana is taking advantage of one of the most beautiful haunted places in town with Ghost Stories at Crown Hill Cemetery on Saturday, October 12th. Sharon Gamble invited Storytelling Arts Executive Director Ellen Munns to tell us more. Be sure to keep the lights on for this story.
Ooh, Ghost Stories, they're back at Crown Hill. They've been around for a long time, but tell me about how you ended up at Crown Hill last year and what you've decided to do there this year.
Well, to be honest, we've wanted to be at Crown Hill for a very long time, but we got a new board member who is great friends with Keith Norwalk at Crown Hill Cemetery.
Mm-hmm.
And so he talked to him, and he's the one who got it done. So
thank you, Steve.
Many thanks to Steve Hamilton. Yes. Yes.
Perfect. Well,
yes.
It's such a natural. And in a way, it strikes me as a little complimentary to Crown Hill does tours, which isn't exactly storytelling, but it's a little bit like storytelling
yes.
in a
yes.
way.
Yes.
So,
mm-hmm.
yeah.
They've been great partners. This is our second year. And we actually set up a tent out in a field at Crown Hill close to the 34th and Boulevard Place entrance. But you can see the headstones and the tombstones. You're surrounded by headstones and tombstones. So it's a perfect setting.
Sure.
So we set up a large tent, and audience members can bring chairs and blankets, and they can bring food, picnics, and coolers.
Oh, so it's a little bit like going to Symphony on the Prairie.
Yes. You can bring beer and wine. Yes. And then this
costumes encouraged for audience?
No, not really. But you can't. We're not going to, you know, we're not going to kick you out if you have a
sure.
costume. But, and this year we'll have some food vendors for those who don't want to pack a picnic. And
you're working on some food trucks? Do
yes,
I have that right?
Food
yeah.
trucks.
Excellent.
Mm-hmm.
Good deal.
And then you come and find a seat, and people spread out even beyond the tent. We make sure that we have sound all the way around the tent. And stories begin at 7:30. They start out very family friendly, and as the evening progresses, they get scarier and scarier.
Uh-huh.
So families know by their own child. You know, if the last story was a little bit too scary for them,
time
they might
to
want
pack
to,
up and go.
Right. But then they get, you know, after the break, they're very much for adults.
Ooh.
And we have 7 storytellers from around the state coming to perform the ghost stories. We've got one person, Cynthia Shangaris, is from Louisville, Kentucky, but that's pretty close by. And then Joshua Wolf lives in Bloomington, and this is the first time we've been able to book him. So I'm very excited that he's going to be telling stories with us. And Stephanie Holman from Spencer, Indiana, and Luann Holman from Angola.
No relation.
No.
Yep.
And Luann, though, performed at Indie Fringe this year.
Right.
And then we have 3 Indianapolis storytellers, Sally Perkins, Bob Sander, and Celestine Bloomfield.
Now, are some of these stories based on real life or, well, depending on whether you believe in ghosts or not, are they based on local legend or myth at all?
No.
No. Okay.
I asked them, well, they could do an urban myth if they wanted to. I don't really know what they're going to tell until that night, but I did ask them to do a folk tale, a literary tale, or an urban myth, not something from their own life.
So for people who aren't as familiar with storytelling, can you kind of define those 3 genres?
Well, folk tales are usually cultural tales from various countries, including the United States, but they're kind of like the personal story of a community. Instead of, if you think about personal family stories or from a family or an individual, the cultural stories, the folk tales are cultural stories, the family story of a community or culture.
Okay.
And urban myths are, well, we all know what an urban myth is. Like here, it would be the House of Blue Lights.
Oh, yeah.
Or the Screaming Bridge. So I'm trying to think what, those are about the only ones that I can think of right now from the Indianapolis area.
Sure.
But but they get to choose what they want to tell.
Mm-hmm.
They just doing it based on where they are in the lineup.
And a literary story would be?
Well, that could be like Edgar Allan Poe.
Got it.
Somebody who wrote scary stories, and they can change it and interpret it into a story for telling. Because there's a difference between reading a story that's been written down and telling a story.
Of course, yeah, absolutely. Mm-hmm. Will your tellers do anything differently because they're A, outdoors, B, in a cemetery, do you think? Add to the atmosphere.
Yes. I just think that they will be themselves. They'll just be themselves and dress warmly if it's cold.
Sure. You're doing, in addition to this event that's, gates open at 6:30 and stories start at 7:30. You're doing a pre-reception, not a VIP reception, but an RIP reception.
Yes.
I love that.
It is from 5 to 7 p.m. Right before Ghost Stories. And if you buy a ticket to go to the RIP reception, that includes your ticket to Ghost Stories. It's going to take place this year in the waiting station. At the waiting station, which is right at the gate, and it includes beer and wine, food. The beer is being donated by Sun King. The food's being donated by Bartow's Caterer, and then we're having live music, and it's just like a preview party. The storytellers will be there, and it'll just be a lot of fun, get everybody ready for Ghost Stories.
And I can't imagine anybody listening to us hasn't been in Crown Hill, but if you're trying to figure out, so where do I go in? You're going to go in off Boulevard at 34th, the beautiful Gothic gates.
Yes.
That are so iconic. So
yes.
If you've seen a picture of the entrance to Crown Hill, you've probably seen the entrance to where you're going for Ghost Stories.
Yes.
Yeah.
And the waiting station is a beautiful building right inside the gate where families used to go to wait before the funerals.
Before the services.
Services.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Cool.
Yes.
Shifting gears, so we're talking about ghost stories and stories of life after death. Can we talk a little bit about the Life Stories Project?
Yes, I would love to. This is our newest project, and we're doing it in collaboration with WFYI and the Indiana Historical Society. And at various venues throughout the city, we're asking people to come and sit in a room with two volunteers and share some of your memories and stories from your own life or childhood or your grandparents or your own children. But it could be stories about your neighborhood. It could be stories about your career.
Sure.
It could be stories about, like, I have a story. I was named after my great-grandmother, you know, and what I know about her. It can be stories about a time you got into trouble.
Ooh.
And so you're just sitting, we're recording the stories, and you're just sitting there with two other people, so it's not a scary type of situation.
Sure. Are the volunteers there to help elicit the story? And
if you need help, yes. And then we have an engineer that makes a clip from your recording, and we take your photograph, and those are placed on the Life Stories Project website. And it's lifestoriesproject.net. And then the full recording is archived at the Oral History Collection at the Indiana Historical Society. And at that point, you will also receive a copy of your recording so you can share it with your family members or friends. So especially for older people who might want to record some of their stories for their children or grandchildren, this is a perfect opportunity to do that.
Yeah, you don't have to find an engineer in the family and rent the equipment and all that kind of stuff.
Yes.
So this sounds like it might be something that people are doing all around the country. Is this?
It's like StoryCorps.
Like StoryCorps, yeah.
Right.
Now, people often think with this sort of project, people often think of older folks.
Mm-hmm.
But I'm guessing you've had some younger people tell stories, too.
Yes, we've had some people in high school tell some stories. And we would love to have more high school age people tell stories. So everyone has a story to share. We tell stories every day. When you get home from school or work, you share it with your family members, what happened to you that day. Or if you get together after work with some friends and you talk about what's been going on in your life. Those are all stories. And we're trying to collect stories, those types of stories right now, in contrast to the storytellers that we bring in once a month that are professional storytellers who are really performers who share their stories from a stage.
Mm-hmm.
It's just a long spectrum of stories of everyday life and then performers. And there's a lot in between.
You know, it's especially important. We have this conversation on the air and off with our friends from the Indiana Historical Society kind of regularly. They remind us that history is not just the stuff we all call the important things.
Right.
History is your memories of dressing up, getting on the bus, and going to Ellis Airs to buy school clothes in, you know, 1986 or whatever
right.
it was.
Because somebody, a child right now, would never think about
won't
doing
have,
that.
And won't know what Ellis Airs was,
right.
probably.
Right. Or going to their tea room. Or I've listened to people share stories of their neighborhood in Indianapolis from 50 years ago, and it's so fascinating to me to see the changes, you mm-hmm. know, in the city, in the town. Or Broad Ripple. You know, Broad Ripple was a separate village.
Right. It was the most popular interurban stop, and people would go up to the White City Amusement Park that was
right.
named after White City in Chicago.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, until the big fire.
Or the Riverside Park.
Mm-hmm. Or yeah, the old zoo, which people
yes.
may not remember. There was a zoo before the current one. Is there a particular community or kind of story I know you've sort of personally been the clearinghouse for scheduling folks for the Life Stories Project. Is there a particular part of the community? You said you'd like to get some more kids, high school kids maybe. Anybody else who maybe hasn't gotten this message you'd particularly like to reach out to?
We have not recorded anybody from the Hispanic community at this point.
Mm-hmm.
So that would be great. But I'm willing to accept stories from anybody and everybody at this point.
Sure.
So if they go to the lifestoriesproject.net website, I put the sites up 1 month at a time. And you can just register right online, and then they will receive an email from me on some tips on how to get ready for it.
That's right, and that's a good reminder that the sites where you can record your story, those sites move around. So
right,
people have
a
lot of – then they can go wherever they're
most comfortable.
Most convenient, most comfortable.
Yes.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And you have other things coming up. I know you have the Emerging Stories Festival coming up in November. You have a holiday event as well.
Yes, and in December, we're bringing in Kim and Reggie Harris. They are gospel singers and storytellers. This will be their first time to Indianapolis, so I'm really pleased to be able to bring them into town. I saw them for the first time last year at the National Storytelling Festival. So that is on December 7th. So I'm really, in December, I like to bring in a storyteller or storytellers that have also a musical background.
Mm-hmm.
It just seems
sure.
like it makes
festive.
It more festive.
Yeah.
So I'm looking forward to that. And another new teller, well, he's not a new teller, but he's new to Indianapolis audience, is Tim Tingle, who's a Native American storyteller. He's a Choctaw.
Mm-hmm.
Storyteller from Texas. He's coming in January, and we are partnering with the Idle George. He'll be doing a family show and a show for some students at the Idle George, and then he'll do the evening performance for adults at the Indiana Historical Society.
Sharon Gamble with Storytelling Arts of Indiana's Executive Director Ellen Munns. Ghost Stories at Crown Hill Cemetery is Saturday, October 12th. Gates open at 6:30 p.m. Stories begin at 7:30. The stories start friendly for all audiences, but grow progressively more frightening as the night wears on. The event is held under a large tent and will be held rain or shine. There's also an RIP, that's RIP, not VIP, but RIP reception, from 5 to 7 before the ghost stories. You can learn more and buy tickets to this event and learn about the rest of Storytelling Arts season at storytellingarts.org.
Hey, Travis.
Yes, Sharon.
Do you know why October has two O's in the word?
Wow. No, I don't.
Because it's a month full of boo.
Ooh, that's good.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And we have some scary things.
Well, we've scared up a few things at least.
On our calendar we call, What'll We Do? What do you have?
Well, you know what? This weekend, there's a free tour on the 5th that's shining a spotlight on modernist architecture. So if you're into all that madman sort of stuff, then you might want to check. And who isn't? You might want to check out Indiana Landmarks Modern Committee Tour that they've put together that is actually being organized by a group called Doko Momo US, and this free walking tour starts on the south side of the NCAA headquarters in the White River State Park, and it's going to last about 90 minutes, and architectural historian Connie Ziegler of Sea Resources is leading the tour of buildings designed by Indianapolis natives, like including Michael Graves, Evans Woolen, and Wright Porteous and Lowe, and national firms such as Skidmore, Owings, and Merrill. So it should be a very cool thing, and that is, again, on Saturday, and you can get more information about the whole thing at Doko Momo, and that's docomomo-us.org, and you can find out all about the tour.
It's just so fun to say.
Doko Momo.
Doko Momo. Hey, I have a correction and a note about fish. I'm just saying.
Okay, go ahead.
The correction is, I'm so sorry, our friend Susan Hyatt at IUPUI, I misidentified her as a sociology professor, and she dropped me a note and said, many of my good friends are sociology professors, but I'm actually an anthropology professor.
Ah.
So I'm so sorry, Susan. So don't send all those emails to us. We know. If her name sounds familiar, it's because she was the ringleader for the Neighborhood of Saturday's cool oral history project on the Near South Side.
Hmm.
On to fish, no connection whatsoever. But the Propylaeum has announced that the first 72 people to respond to this announcement, don't call us. You're going to call the Propylaeum. I'll give you the phone number in a moment. can join them for the inaugural Alaska and Puget Sound Salmon Fest. There will be 8 wonderful courses, 5 varieties of salmon, and 8 Pacific Northwest wines. Wow, yum. Mm. Wonderful piano music, great way to start the winter season. When is this lovely thing? It's November 1st at 7 p.m., and reservations are required, and, of course, quantities, space limited for 72 people. And here's that phone number to call, 317-638-7881, 317-638-7881.
Sharon, you know who else likes fish?
Cats.
Cats do. That's right. And right now, this has nothing to do with the arts, but the Humane Society is running a special cat adoptions. All cats 7 months and older only have a $9 adoption fee now through Sunday, October 13th. So this is a great time to adopt a cat if you want to. That has nothing to do with anything else
but
other than I just wanted to.
But cats make you more artistic. Hemingway kept cats.
That's right.
If you've been to his Key West estate, they're the descendants of his cats.
Real quick thing. I want to make sure that we get in, and that is The Tempest at Garfield Park this weekend. The Garfield Shakespeare Company is presenting The Tempest this weekend, and it's going to be outside, which should be kind of interesting, October 4th and 5th, 8 p.m. both days.
Maybe tempestuous. My last item, don't forget the Navajo Rug Auction at the Eideljorg this Saturday, 9:30 to 11, a preview, 11:30 a.m., the actual auction.
That sounds very good. And you know what? There's a ton of First Friday stuff going on, too, including James Woolley Faust at Gallery 924, as well as stuff at the Harrison and down in Fountain Square.
The Painting Indiana 3 show is still up at Indiana Landmark Center.
Nice. Actually, worth checking out.
Yep.
Absolutely. Okay. Well, Sharon, we will be back next week.
On that calendar we call,
What'll We Do? Oh, boo.
You're listening to The Art of the Matter, a weekly show about the arts in Indianapolis and Central Indiana. Your hosts are Sharon Gamble and Travis DiNicola. If your arts organization has an event or activity of which you think we should be aware, please contact us at least 3 weeks in advance. You can write us at The Art of the Matter, care of WFYI, 1630 North Meridian Street, Indianapolis, Indiana, 46202. Or you can email us at artofthematter@wfyi.org. You can also hear The Art of the Matter on WFYI.org.
Simply put, Jan Rutenberg is possibly the greatest architect you've never heard of. And after 2 years of research, on October 4th, the Indianapolis Museum of Contemporary Art will open the retrospective of Rutenberg's work, Come Here, Architect. Travis DiNicola spoke with Rutenberg's grandson, Wes von Rutenberg, about the show.
Vess, welcome to Art of the Matter. Great to have you here.
Great to be here. Thank you.
This is going to be a really interesting show, I think, at IMOCA. And, you know, I've already heard it described as, you know, Jan Rutenberg's for the most famous and important architect that most people don't know of. And it's a really kind of fascinating story. And he was your grandfather. You never met, though, correct? Or did you?
Yes.
I wasn't sure quite of the timeline here. So
we shared
let's start
the planet for 7 years. Yeah. He died in 75. I was, you know, 7.
Okay,
you can figure it out from there. Yeah.
So what are your memories of your grandfather then?
Well, I remember him, even if he was sort of sleepy and listless in his chair, as you know, at the end of a meal, he still seemed to command the room and be a bit of the most important person there. It was always a bit of, oh, you know, your grandfather's coming over and cleaning up a bit about him.
You know?
He would, whenever everyone would leave the room, he'd start telling me about all the things he designed and asking me about things. And this chair, I designed this chair, he would say, you know, and that kind of thing. And he would always, he'd like to, you know, talk to me about it. He bought me blocks and bought me my first little piano. It was a little color-coded piano.
Sure, the different colors on the keys, right?
Which I felt like was kind of a sort of Bauhaus way of learning music, the colored thing. And now that I look back on it, it was a unique experience for me, for sure.
That's pretty amazing. So, I mean, what great memories for that, to be able to have that. And at what point for you did you sort of realize, oh, my grandfather is kind of a big deal here?
Well, again, when I was young, when my parents got divorced, I ended up shuffling off to Colorado with my dad and my sister. And we without really realizing it at first, ended up living in his house in Colorado Springs that he'd built for himself,
okay.
which was a fully 20s modernist house at the foothills of the mountains of Colorado Springs. It was great. And I didn't really understand why it was so different, or that maybe lots of people's houses might be like this. I didn't know, but the giant windows and the terraces for every bedroom, mm-hmm. almost every room in the house opened outside except for the bathrooms. They were just the house was always trying to thrust you into the fresh air, mm-hmm. on the roof or out on a porch. And it was very well appointed, mm-hmm. with old furniture, hundreds of years old, hand-carved furniture, and brand new, at least seeming to me, it was already 50 years old then, but this chrome furniture with the leather stretched around it, and it seemed so exotic, you know?
Sure.
But it was great, and what I really got out of it was a sense of nature, and it was only later that I thought, oh, this is, you know, something futuristic, if you will.
Mm-hmm. And when you were then, I mean, a teenager, did you start to sort of realize the significance of the work that your grandfather had done, working with, you know, other great architects like, you know, Mies van der Rohe and Philip Johnson, you know, Herman Miller. I mean, quite an amazing list. I mean, and I want to get into sort of his biography here in just a moment. But, you know, when did you sort of discover that part?
Well, again, it was kind of a pivotal moment in my life when my father died in 1996. I ended up, as a lot of sons do, going through his belongings, mm-hmm. and kind of nonchalant in the back of my old bedroom, shoved in a corner, were these boxes. Mm-hmm. And they had photographs and newspaper clippings and letters from Nelson Rockefeller from the 30s and all this stuff. And the more I looked at it, and at the time I was working at Midland Antiques here in town in the 90s, and as a musician, I was fascinated in all things artistic anyway, but this really started to, all of a sudden I realized I was looking at things that I was seeing in the antique world as mm-hmm. being very valued and very highly acclaimed and respected, and it all started to make sense. I found chairs made at the Bauhaus in the garage on the east side, you know, the house I grew up in.
Right.
And so at that point, I realized there's something very special.
It really
special.
Started to click. Yeah.
He wasn't just an architect and built some buildings. And there's no reason to do an exhibition about everyone's grandfather who was an architect. And mm-hmm. my dad was an architect, and I won't do an exhibition on him. he just did what he could and made mm-hmm. money and built some things. And they weren't earth-changing. But this guy, the more I looked at him and examined him, and he started to come to me, too. I started to get phone calls from people who found out I had some of his collection. And the first thing that happened was in 1999, the Whitney called me and had me inform them or send them some of his information for the Mies in America book. And then it kind of started from there, and it hasn't really stopped, this sort of roller coaster.
I mean, that's kind of a heads up when you get a call
absolutely.
From the Whitney, you know,
yes, absolutely.
And stuff. So he had an amazing career, was very important, you know, certainly both was influenced by and influenced other great architects and designers of the 20th century, but he's not as well known. And that's a really kind of both fascinating and honestly, I mean, terribly sad part of the story here.
It's true. It's true. But at the same time, somebody's got to open the door so someone else can run through it. And we see mm-hmm. this a lot in art. There had to be Rocket 88 in 1951 so that Elvis Presley could come, and Elvis Presley had to come so that the Beatles could run mm-hmm. in through the door. And everything had to happen for the next thing. And I think Jan, by being he was the first to teach at a major university here, this new European architecture in 1934, and he doesn't necessarily need to be acclaimed for that so much as he squeezed open the door for all the other people fleeing Nazi Germany just a year or two later to run through that and then get jobs at Harvard and Yale and IIT and all these, mm-hmm. you know. So I feel that he was a little more popular in his day. He was in Time mm-hmm. magazine in 1938, and he certainly, Herman Miller, you know, Gilbert Rohde and Jan Rutenberg were the only designers for Herman Miller at that time
okay.
in 1937. Got a little tongue-tied there, but
yeah. So I mean, he was getting this great recognition, had this, you know, very strong career going on at that point,
mm-hmm.
and then it kind of came to an end, right?
It did. At some point, he moved out west in the dream of pursuing a career out there, and it was great because in that way...
And as you said, Colorado, I mean, that was sort of like home base of operation, right?
Definitely. Okay. He trailblazed modernism there, but he sort of lost this presence in New York that happened, and he was also outed for his homosexuality mm-hmm. in the 50s, which didn't sit well with his somewhat high crust clientele out there,
yeah,
for sure. And it kind of sent him on a little bit of a tailspin, of course, in the late 50s and 60s. That early modernism, it gets a little unfashionable as well.
Yeah.
And so I think he struggled with all of that.
But that's the part, too, that I think is just so sad, that, you know, that at that time in America, in the especially the early 50s, to be outed as being gay was such an unusual thing anyway, to be sort of publicly outed like that.
Absolutely.
And then, you know, for the client base and for the public to respond in a way that just wasn't accepting, of course.
Yes. And of course, is next to...
I mean, it's one of those things you have to guess that, like, a lot of people knew, but then once it was out there, it was like, oh, now we can't support him? Or, I mean, do you know much about that history, or...?
I don't. I suspect that it was something like Liberace. You know, you were allowed... Mm-hmm. He was allowed to be Liberace, but he just couldn't come out and say it, maybe.
Yeah.
I don't know.
Yeah.
Maybe it was like that. I do know that several gay clients in the Springs sort of stepped up and hired him after mm-hmm. everything, you know, but it is strange to imagine in this day and age that happening.
Yeah,
you'd almost prefer your decorator to be gay. You
know? So this exhibit, tell me a bit about what is going to be shown at IMOCA.
Well, we are going to be showing his life's work, the very best of the best, and some in between, from Sweden and Germany in the early 30s, all the way through his World's Fair line of furniture and an interior from 39, and his fabulous houses in the 40s, 50s, and 60s in Colorado Springs.
How cool!
So it's just a great timeline of his life. And we have various surprises, of course. I don't want to give everything away.
Sure,
it's going to be a very beautiful exhibit.
But, you know, we mentioned Herman Miller, but also he designed for Greta Garbo, Nelson Rockefeller, the Swedish royal family. I mean,
absolutely,
some pretty big, you know, clients there.
He was he really had a great run early on with the most impressive list of people. And we will be showing a lot of that work. And it's really it's the kind of work where there may have been people who are even better at the time, but they didn't have such wealthy clients who could carry such wonderful things out. Mm. And in a few mm-hmm. instances, not always, he really got to build magical things that a lot of people never get to who are great architects. So
the work that's going to be exhibited, it will include both drawings as well as physical pieces.
Yes.
And now, is this all or almost all from what you've sort of inherited or?
Almost all, yes.
Wow.
We've culled some things from elsewhere, but most of it comes from his personal collection, his mm-hmm. his chairs, his table, his photographs, and it's even largely narrated by his personal letters and biography.
Oh, great.
So we tried to show, don't tell, they say. So we're mm-hmm. trying to, you know, show his stuff, and it's a little more interesting that way.
What did it mean for you to work on this?
Well, in a way, it's been a bit of a catharsis. It's been a growing thing. Like I said, people call me. They talk to me about mm-hmm. it. It's been a growing responsibility. I'll get emails in the middle of breakfast and feel compelled to talk and get back to people. And maybe this is a way of actually addressing that. The specter of my grandfather has grown and grown, and he's actually kind of – I feel like he's around and generating this, and he likes it and wants this thing to happen. And maybe it'll be a sense of completion at the end of it. But, of course, I'm planning on taking the exhibit to other places.
Sure.
And IMOCA has been terrific, and I have to thank Jeremy Efimson for being
of course
so wonderful about this and my co-curator on the whole thing. And it's been really the ride, one of the rides of my life. As a musician, I've had some good ones, but this has been a completely new endeavor.
But you're also a designer yourself.
Yes.
I have to imagine that your grandfather's work has had some influence on you.
Absolutely. I would say it's why I'm interested.
Mm-hmm.
And he had this way about him, and my father was the same way. If you looked at something and you said, oh, I like that house, mm-hmm. they wouldn't just let that go. Mm-hmm. You had to explain, why do you like it? Mm-hmm. What do you like about it? Really? Why? And you'd always have to explain yourself. If you didn't like something, you were almost more interviewed about it. You know, you had to really explain yourself. And then you start to learn what it is you like, why you like it, what it is that you don't like, and why. And that that really informs you right there. If you have any artistic sense, it just starts to grow from that.
Did you learn anything about your grandfather that you didn't already know as you started working on this, putting
almost
together?
Every day.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's just something will literally fall out of a book, and I'll stand up and read it out loud. You know? Yeah, it's been... It's been really interesting.
Anything specific you could share with us, or without giving too much?
Well, he had an interesting conversation back and forth with Richard Nixon, actually. He got a letter from him asking him if he, as a faculty member of various universities and a celebrated architect, if he could recommend anyone to head up their housing department.
And wow.
Of course, he can't think of anybody but himself, and he nominates himself, and then they have to write him back and let him down easy. But it's great. It's a great little. I didn't know that existed until recently.
That's pretty cool. Vess, this is awesome. I can't wait to see the show. Congratulations to you on being able to put this together and let us all learn a lot more about Jan Rutenberg, your grandfather.
Thank you very much. It's a pleasure.
Travis DiNicola with Vess von Rutenberg. The exhibit of his grandfather's work opens at IMOCA, the Indianapolis Museum of Contemporary Art, in Fountain Square on October 4th. You can get more information at indymocha.org. That's IndyMocha.org. Thanks for joining us today. The music for today's show is courtesy of the Buselli Wallerab Jazz Orchestra from their Heart and Soul album, available through Owls Studios at owlstudios.com.
Please listen to The Art of the Matter next week, Thursday at 8 p.m. and Saturday at 7 a.m., when I'll take a look at a collection of mysteries called Hoosier Hoops and Hijinks.
I'll get a preview of Indianapolis's next TEDx event.
And I'll test out some of the furniture in the Fearless Furniture exhibit at the State Museum. Plus, we'll have that arts calendar we call
What Do We Do? So please listen next weekend to The Art of the Matter here on 90.1 WFYI Public Radio.
You've been listening to The Art of the Matter, a weekly show about the arts in Central Indiana and Indianapolis. Your hosts are Sharon Gamble and Travis DiNicola. Today's show was edited by Melissa Davis and produced by Travis DiNicola. The Art of the Matter, made possible by the ongoing support of listeners like you.